apologize. I apologize on behalf of the court for starting our late. Our first case, one of the parties, unfortunately, was involved in an accident and will be delayed. So our second case will be heard first today, and the court appreciates the courtesy of the lawyers in taking their case now. I also want to welcome the Watertown High School group who has managed to make it in this treacherous weather. Would these students please rise? Welcome to you all. Please be seated. The Lincoln High School class from Wisconsin Rapids has not arrived, and we don't know if they're expected. But the Watertown High School group will meet with me at noon, and we will then discuss the processes and procedures of the court. The Watertown High School class is here with our national award-winning Courtless Class program. And the students have received synopses of the case and may have discussed the case with counsel or others. And for the rest of you in this audience, there are synopses of the case outside on a table. Anyone who wishes to join us at noon is welcome. We have met you. Now I'd like to introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Next to him is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. And to his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far left, Justice David Prosser. And with these introductions and other matters taken care of, we'll call the second case, 97-1839-CR, State v. Easley, is it? Okay. Mr. Torvinen, you represent Mr. Easley. And you will proceed, please.
Thank you, Justice. May it please the court, counsel, members of the citizenry, the facts of this case, my name is Kyle Torvinen. I am an attorney from Superior, Wisconsin, and I represent Mr. Easley. He was the defendant in the trial court. He is the petitioner and the appellant in the matter currently before the court. The facts of this case have been set forth at length and certainly won't be belabored here in the briefing that's been performed by the attorneys. Suffice it to say that Mr. Easley, at all times pertinent to this matter, was in federal custody, and that on three occasions, the state, by its prosecutor, petitioned the circuit court for a writ of habeas corpus ad prosecundum. Those writs were issued, and those writs commanded the federal prison system, by its warden, to deliver Mr. Easley to the state for prosecutorial processes. Therefore, it's undisputed that on no less than three occasions, Mr. Easley was shuttled back and forth between federal jurisdiction and state jurisdiction, which is contrary to Article 4C of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, and also the prosecution took place beyond a 120-day deadline, which is established and is contrary to Article 4C of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers. And those shuttles and the 120-day provisions, these things are undisputed, but it moves us to a threshold issue. And that is whether the procedures that were employed by the state invoked the procedure of the IAD and the protections that are established thereby, and whether the procedures which were used, more importantly, are constitutionally permissible. A detainer is any notification, even if it's informal, that a prisoner is wanted in another jurisdiction for prosecution. The interstate agreement on detainers, without belaboring that point, because I'm well aware that the court is familiar with the provisions of the IAD, was set up, and Article 1 specifically said that individuals against whom detainers are lodged, that it has a tendency to, quote, obstruct programs of prisoner rehabilitation. And to cut to the chase, the United States Supreme Court, in Cooler v. Adams, in 101 Supreme Court at 212, quoting the United States Congress, indicated that prisoners against whom detainers are lodged are, quote, seriously disadvantaged, end quote, by having detainers lodged against them. To prevent that, the IAD was passed, and its purpose is twofold, as is set forth in Article 1. The first purpose is to set forth a uniform procedure to cooperate between member party jurisdictions and to basically to streamline the process in transferring prisoners between jurisdictions. The second purpose is to protect prisoners from interference with their rehabilitation. And of those two purposes, the Supreme Court, again in 449 U.S. at 448, 449, indicated that the primary purpose of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers is to protect prisoners. To that end, Article 9 specifically indicates that the Interstate Agreement on Detainers must be liberally construed to effectuate its purpose. Turning then to the substance of the case, the question becomes, what did the state do wrong and how did they run afoul of the Constitution and the IAD? The state did two things wrong in this case. The first thing they did is in issuing the writ of habeas corpus ad prosecundum, because the state has no authority to issue that document to a federal body of any type. Morrow makes it clear. And the case of Morrow is...
Let me interrupt you, if I might, for a minute. When you say the state issued the writ, literally, was it issued by the state or was it issued by the court?
It was issued by the court, Justice.
Isn't that a significant difference? That's certainly the distinction that was drawn by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Morrow case. And why is it not as significant here as it was there?
For constitutional reasons, Justice, the first is that there's a difference in that the federal writ of habeas corpus ad prosecundum being issued to a state authority, assuming that there's courts on both ends issuing them, the writ being issued by the federal body, it's guaranteed that the issues that the IAD was meant to protect will not be followed up by the federal action because of the supremacy clause. The federal writ can guarantee that it will be immediately executed. Even if issued by a state court, Justice, the state writ, there is no guarantees because of the supremacy clause that a state writ will be executed.
But in fact, in this particular case, it was executed, and the federal authorities clearly complied with the writ, did they not?
They did. And in the reason that too runs afoul of the Constitution, and the reason why, it takes us back to a bit of a history lesson, but in Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2 of the Constitution of the United States is the executive authority clause that indicates that when a felon is to be transported across state lines, that the executive authorities of the two states must confer. The supremacy clause, the reason that the Supreme Court allowed the writ of habeas corpus from the federal authority is because of the guaranteed action of the supremacy clause. The reason that we don't have, and it does also not run afoul of that executive privilege clause, because the right of the federal government and its courts to issue writs of habeas corpus ad prosecundum is guaranteed by the legislature as signed by the president. And so the executive authority exists in that instance. In this instance, we have a state court who is an underling, not approved by the executive authority of the state of Wisconsin, issuing a writ to a warden, which is also not approved by the executive authority. That situation can be analogized to, for example, the extradition process that requires the executive of one state to issue a petition to the executive of another state. The reason that that procedure exists and was developed prior to the IAD was precisely so that it would meet that constitutional mandate that the executives confer.
Isn't it possible as a matter of comity that one jurisdiction will indeed honor the writ of another? What's wrong with that? That's obviously, again, what went on in this case.
The reason that would be constitutionally impermissible pursuant to Article 4, Clause 2, Section 2, the Executive Authority Clause, because comity, the act of comity in this case of transferring a prisoner, the warden has no such authority. It was an unconstitutional, impermissible transfer. The concept of comity exists. I understand that the concept of comity exists, but because of the nature of this proceeding and because the Constitution takes precedence over equitable notions such as comity, comity cannot exist in this case because it would be an unconstitutional act.
So I was going to ask, and I understand your constitutional argument, and the state, of course, is making an argument that there was comity, could use comity, and as long as the warden honored it, that is how you would be able to use this particular writ. My question to you is, what case law are you relying on? Are you saying you can't do it because the Constitution, as you cited, says so? That's it? Is there some case that you know of that would support your position?
I apologize to the court. I have been accused before of not having delved far enough into it. I do rely exclusively on the Constitution. My understanding of the Executive Authority Clause and the information that I had received the Executive Authority Clause of Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2 specifically, by its nature, prohibits the transfer of prisoners across state lines without executive authority.
Well, but I'm reading the right clause. Says a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime. Is that the one?
That's correct.
Who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. So you think this guy has fled from justice? I mean, I don't know that clause, and I haven't researched it, but wasn't he in prison in the federal penitentiary?
That's correct, Justice. And what I would cite to, again, by analogy, likewise with the extradition proceedings. The reason that we have extradition proceedings and what they are meant to comply with is precisely that clause. Likewise with extradition proceedings, the individual is being held in another jurisdiction, it's not necessarily that they have been in flight. They're being held in another jurisdiction, but the transfer must comply with that provision of the Constitution.
And you think that this uniform statute is a compliance mechanism?
I believe it is.
The only compliance mechanism.
I believe that it is the only method because of the fact that the federal government, by its Congress and the President, are signatories to this document, and as a party member, as well as 48 of the 50 states, including Wisconsin, through 976-05 Wisconsin statutes, as a federal compact, it satisfies the Executive Authority Clause because it has been approved by both of the executive authorities as the appropriate procedure. Likewise, it does not run afoul of the Supremacy Clause.
When was this enacted?
I believe it was enacted in Wisconsin in 1985, if I am not mistaken.
When did the feds enact it?
Excuse me?
When did the feds enact it?
I do not know the answer to that, Justice. I apologize.
If we took your argument, then the two signatories that didn't join, what did they do? And what happened before 1985? I mean, was no one ever moved from one state to the other? I can't believe that.
Justice, the Supreme Court's decision in the United States v. Morrow speaks very specifically to that issue at pages 355 and 356, footnote 23, indicating precisely what procedures the state used to have to follow before the protections of the IAD. That's the part one answer to your question. To answer the second portion of your question, Chief Justice, my client, Mr. Easley, on April 9th, 1998, without my knowledge, without my consent, submitted a document on a motion to supplement the record.
I have that in front of me. Okay.
And the court held that document in abeyance. And I would humbly submit to this court that as an attorney, I did not understand the import of what Mr. Easley took to do on his own. That document, which has attachments A1 through A13, A13 through A17 to that attachment is a program statement that was issued by the United States Department of Justice. And although Mr. Easley may not have followed the appropriate procedures because he isn't an attorney, I would submit to the court that that is a document of which this court, because it was issued by the federal government, the United States Department of Justice, can take judicial notice of. That document answers the second part to your question. It tells you precisely what procedures must be followed by the two states that are not signatory. And that is that within that program statement, at A13, if you look to page 2, starting at the top of that document, it reads, the first full paragraph, the procedures in this program statement are not to be used to avoid the IAD or MORO. Thus, if the IAD or MORO applies, or would apply if a detainer had been filed, then a detainer must be filed.
Well, I know that, counsel, and this is directed to the federal prison system.
Correct.
In the Fed, and it is a policy statement, as I read it, to the federal corrections officers, that is the wardens, telling them, and Mr. Carlson was the director, as he used to say, of the largest hotel facility in the country. And so this is how they should proceed, but it's not a legal document in the sense that it's the only way that the warden can proceed. I mean, I suppose if the warden or superintendent didn't follow what Mr. Carlson said, Mr. Carlson might have words with him, but it's not that this is the only way of doing it. I mean, the very fact that they put out this kind of thing is a policy document, not a constitutional interpretation of the only process, as I read it.
And I would acknowledge that. What I read the document as is an admission that if a detainer, if MORO or the IAD would apply if a detainer had been filed, then a detainer must be filed. I'm pointing out that the reason that this document exists, it's an admission by the federal prison system that unless we're not talking about a signatory state, that they must follow the IAD or MORO. And so it begs your question, which is why? Why can't they do something else? And the reason that they can't harkens back again to the idea of there is no, without the IAD, by issuing a writ through a state court judge that's going directly to a federal correctional institution warden, it runs afoul of Article 4, Clause 2, Section 2, because the executive authority must have approved it, which, pursuant to the IAD, it is approved.
Let's read the second paragraph. Maybe we just not understand. The Office of Legal Counsel, Department of Justice, has ruled that prisoners may lawfully be transferred to the physical custody of state agents pursuant to state writ of habeas corpus on first offending. Or on tests of conduct. That means if they're going to be prosecuted or the criminal is going to be testifying. This reverses the long-standing interpretation that except for transfers to state agents under IAD, inmates had to remain in federal custody. And so production was always made by U.S. Marshals. I can't read what that last first word was in that sentence. So it says you can go around IAC.
But the document itself, as I read it, respectfully submitted, is that this document itself, although it was submitted to all of the prison systems from the Department of Justice, the document itself applies only to those instances where the state is not a signatory or MORO or IAD don't apply.
But your concept is that you can't do that because it's unconstitutional.
My argument would be I did not delve into what the Department of Justice did in their, within the program statement, or whether it was approved by an executive authority or not. It may be, I don't know exactly what the Department of Justice's intent was. I'm citing to this document, it may be that it is unconstitutional procedure. I'm merely citing to it for the admission contained herein that I believe that the reason that the portion of this document that I have cited, the reason I believe it's in there, indicating that it is not to be used to avoid the IAD or moral and must not be under these facts, is because it is attempting to comply with the constitutional provisions I've cited.
Counsel, I'd like to swing to another issue. Let's assume that a detainer was issued. I have, in view of the fact that you requested extra time so that your new attorney could prepare for trial, your client did this, in view of the fact that there was a request on behalf of your client for extra time for discovery, and that there was no objection made to the scheduling of a preliminary hearing and trial outside of the 120 days, don't those constitute a waiver of the 120 day period?
Justice, the facts of what constitutes a waiver and what doesn't are set forth in the transcripts. I would submit that they do not. However, to answer your question directly, the 120-day provision, for the purposes of this argument, assuming arguendo that he did waive the 120-day provision, there is no argument that has even been proposed by the state indicating that he waived the anti-shuttling provisions of Article 4E. And for that reason, the remedy for a violation of the IAD, whether it be the 120-day deadline or the anti-shuttling provisions, is the same. And because the facts relative to the anti-shuttling stand largely uncontested, and not largely, they stand wholly uncontested, the 120-day, and because the remedies are the same, it's moot.
So your position is, even if those three things that I referenced, the asking for extra time for an attorney, asking for extra time for discovery, and not voicing an objection to scheduling beyond 120 days, even if those three things constitute waiver of 120 day period, you still have not waived the anti-shuttle. Is that correct?
That's correct, Justice. Our position, to follow up on that briefly, our position is that whether something is a waiver or not is a question of fact. We believe that under the transcript that was submitted, it was in fact the state. In fact, some of the portion of what you, part of what you've indicated, Record 35, which I believe was the preliminary hearing, and Mr. Van Hollen, the prosecutor, indicated at page 62, lines 3 through 8, the only problem is we need to make it, I guess, far enough down the road to get the necessary writs together. And then he goes on to say, this is interesting, the federal government is a little bit pickier about what's in their writs and how much advance notice they have, and I want to make sure that we have enough time to comply with their requirements.
Okay, let's say, on your waiver issue with regard to the 120 days, what about the removal to, or being returned to Minnesota? Was any objection voiced by your client to be returned to Minnesota before the Wisconsin charges were resolved? And if no objection was voiced, doesn't that constitute waiver?
To answer the first part of your question, no objection was voiced. To answer the second part of your question, I do not believe that it does constitute waiver because the arguments that are cited by the state are that if somebody requests something affirmatively that is inconsistent with the protections that are set forth in the IAD, i.e., if you request a trial date or a hearing date that's sometime beyond 120 days, that's an affirmative request for an inconsistency. In this case, Mr. Easley made no affirmative request, and although I did not bring the case law with me, I believe that my brief at either this level or the appellate court cites to a number of decisions which indicate that it does require some affirmative request for something that is inconsistent. I see that I'm short on time.
You have 5 minutes, almost approximately. Then you have 5 minutes and you've got...
Could I ask, what is the procedure that you think that the district attorney and the court should have followed?
I believe that the district attorney and the court in this case, Justice, should have issued a detainer, which it is my position that they did. Because the writ has no effect on the federal court, it's a worthless piece of paper because of the supremacy clause, that when they filed the writ with the attached petition and the complaint, because it had no force as a writ for constitutional reasons, it was in fact a detainer. So I believe it was filed. What they could have done, very simply, is filed a detainer and followed the processes of the IED, requested that he be transferred, taken care of it within 120 days, and kept him in Ashland County until he was the determination on the state charges was completed.
So your determination is that they simply should have kept him in Wisconsin in jail and not returned him to Minnesota, is that right?
That is what the IAD requires, Justice.
Now, the fact, how is he injured in any way by going back to Minnesota?
Justice, the provisions of the IAD do not require, although some of the prior state authorities in different jurisdictions required some showings of prejudice, and I don't have a citation for you, but there is absolutely no requirement of a showing of prejudice to the prisoner. I would be happy to submit additional authorities on that at the court's request.
Didn't you say that one of the purposes of the interstate agreement was to not disrupt whatever programs the prisoner is going through? Wouldn't the return to the federal facility be more likely to facilitate any programming he was going through than keeping him in jail in Ashland?
No, and there's a policy reason for that, Justice. The reason why is that once an individual has been requested, the reason for that, as I understand it, for the 120-day must prosecute, keep them in that jurisdiction, is because then there's a guarantee that the charges will either be resolved, dismissed, or he will be convicted. By returning them, the jurisdiction that originally transported him now knows precisely what the Detainer Act was meant to prevent. They now know that he's being charged with something. He's brought back into that jurisdiction, and they're saying, well, he's a criminal in another jurisdiction. He's being charged with some other things that are over there, and all of the things that the IAD, in the case of Morrow, were meant to prevent.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice.
Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
If it plays the court, the specific federal constitutional issue that was addressed and discussed at some length here this morning, I do not recall was raised in precisely those terms in the court below. And I don't have Article 4, Section 2 of the United States Constitution before me. However, I'm confident that that particular provision of the Constitution deals with extradition of prisoners, and the executive authority who is identified in that clause is the governor of a state. And the framers of the Constitution were concerned that governors of the state had a responsibility to deliver prisoners and that a state would not become an asylum for someone who had escaped the criminal jurisdiction in another state. The reason I believe that particular clause is not applicable is because the prisoner in this case was not in the custody of any state executive authority. He was in the custody of the federal government. The federal government had authority and jurisdiction to move the prisoner anywhere within this country. For example, that prisoner could have been moved from the federal correctional institution in Sandstone, which is in the state of Minnesota, to the Oxford facility, which is in the state of Wisconsin. And the executive authority in the state of Wisconsin would not be involved in that process at all. And I think that's just simply the answer to the question, constitutional question that was addressed here, is that the executive authority identified in Article 4, Section 2 is the governor of a state and not the federal executive. Now, it is clear that in the definition of terms in the Uniform Agreement on Detainers, the federal government is a state within the definition, and that as a matter of convenience and an attempt perhaps at uniformity, the federal government is a party to the compact, and this is a procedure that could be used to temporarily transfer the custody of a prisoner to a state jurisdiction or to another federal jurisdiction for the purposes of trial. But I do not see that that it's an exclusive remedy or that there is any constitutional issue posed by the procedure that was followed in this particular case. I think what happened in this particular case, although I have no personal knowledge, but what happened, I think, in this case is that there was a geographical proximity here between Ashland County and the Federal Correctional Institution in Sandstone, Minnesota, and that the writ of habeas corpus issued by the state judge could be executed there and the transfer of the prisoner done on a daily basis. In other words, he could be brought in for an initial appearance, a preliminary hearing, or whatever court procedure was involved, and returned immediately. If the prisoner was in, for example, the correctional institution in Leavenworth, this type of process would not work.
Who pays for the transfer of the prisoners to the state?
The state of Wisconsin would. And very specifically, the Ashland County would pay for the transfer.
Is it cheaper to transfer them two or three times or keep them in an Ashland jail?
I'm sure it is much cheaper to provide the transportation involved in this case rather than house him for weeks and perhaps months in the county jail.
According to these briefs, this procedure of using the writ rather than using the uniform law is quite prevalent in Wisconsin. Is that your understanding?
My understanding would be that it is not prevalent. I've been involved in the uniform compacts governing extradition detainers for approximately 20 years, and I don't recall any conversation with the prosecutor, either out of state or in this state, involving the use of the writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum to attain a federal prisoner. So I would say it was very rare. And I guess the point I wanted to make in my brief, and to reiterate this morning, is I don't see that there's any advantage to the prosecutor to going to the judge, filing a petition, obtaining the writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum, and issuing it that way, and obtaining custody through this process, rather than simply sending a request to the administrator here in Madison that's established by statute, and having the transfer done administratively. I think in this case it was just a matter, as I indicated, of geographical proximity, and for whatever reason, the prosecutor chose to use the state writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum. I suppose, in my administrative sense, if a prosecutor called me up, I would have to tell him that a state writ issued by a state judge would not necessarily be executed or honored by a warden in a federal prison, and I would not recommend it. But what happened in this particular case, whether it was on an individual basis or as a matter of policy, the federal authorities at the Sandstone Correctional Institution honored and immediately had the writ executed, and the prisoner was brought back to Wisconsin for the individual court case.
Counsel, as a factual matter, was the
yes.
complaint for the Wisconsin charges attached to the habeas corpus writ?
I do not know, and the issue was not raised in the trial court as to whether or not the complaint was attached. So it's not part of the record, and we have really no basis to conclude if it was or if it was not. It's not part of the record.
Assuming that it was, then
But the argument is that the complaint affects the detainer. Isn't that correct?
I understand the argument, Justice. And I guess my response to that is that the complaint will be part of the petition asking the circuit judge to issue the writ. It would not be an independent document standing by itself that would act as a detainer. And I guess I think the distinction which the United States Supreme Court clearly drew in the Morrow decision is this. A detainer is simply a notice that's filed with prison authorities that there are untried charges in another state or in another jurisdiction. And that is all it is. Simply a notice. It's not a request for transfer. It doesn't affect the transfer. It's simply a notice.
Well, wouldn't attaching a complaint then to the writ certainly give them notice that there are pending charges in Wisconsin jurisdiction? I mean, doesn't it? You're right. At Morrow, as I read that at page 358, it says, "Senior is merely to serve as notice." Well, it seems to me attaching a complaint saying there are pending charges to Wisconsin gives the notice.
I would agree, Justice. The distinction here is that the notice comes with a request to transfer the prisoner to the state jurisdiction so that all the dangers, all the injury that the prisoner might suffer does not occur. Because if you read the Morrow decision in the congressional notes that are in there, what they were concerned with was detainers, that is, notices that were filed at the institution and sat there for months, possibly years, with nothing happening. In this case, even assuming the complaint was attached to the writ says, this is a request for temporary custody. We are asking you to deliver him on a certain date for trial in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, it seems to me that the complaint is notice, and you agree with that. You're saying it's notice plus. Well, it seems to me as long as it's at least notice, then you arguably have a detainer, and there is an arguable violation of the anti-shuffling statute or provision. I mean, it may be a complaint may be notice plus A plus B plus C, but just because you have A plus B plus C doesn't take away the fact that it is still notice. It puts the federal authorities on notice that there are pending charges, which is, under Morrow, the purpose of a detainer. By the way, what's wrong with that, in fact?
I guess I respectfully disagree. I think what I would point out is, taking the assumption which has been made here by the court for the sake of argument, that a complaint was attached as part of the petition and ultimately be relevant with the writ of habeas that was served on the federal authorities, I think in response we could assume that the complaint was not attached. The writ of habeas corpus would still notify the federal authorities that there are untried charges in the state of Wisconsin. So I don't think you can take that and create a detainer for the purposes of the agreement on detainers. And I think that's important. The agreement on detainers has very specific remedies.
Does a complaint in any way transfer the signing authority from the court to a prosecutor?
It does not.
Isn't that an important distinction? A detainer based on a complaint is one thing. That issue's from a prosecutor, correct?
A detainer?
Yeah.
Based on a complaint?
Yeah.
I think in response to that, I think many times a detainer will simply be a copy of a complaint, information, indictment, perhaps, and or an arrest warrant that's mailed to the prison officials, perhaps with a copy or a cover letter indicating that charges are outstanding in Ashland County, for example, or some other county in the state.
The point that I make is I don't understand how a complaint can change the nature of a writ, because a writ can only be
I guess I'm making your argument for you. Seems to me a writ can, correct me if I'm wrong, a writ can only be issued by a judge, right?
That is correct.
Whereas a detainer can be issued by a prosecutor.
A detainer almost all, yeah, the court would not be involved in the process of filing a detainer because it's simply a notice by the prosecutor that there are untried charges.
So are there any circumstances in which a complaint attached to a writ can change the nature of the writ in the sense that it is no longer a court issuing the writ?
My answer is no. And I think that was the distinction I was trying to draw, that even though a writ might be, in general terms, a notice also of untried charges, what it is a writ issued by a court requesting custody of the prisoner for trial. And because it is that, and because it is immediately executed, the Supreme Court in Morrill says, it is not a detainer for purposes of the agreement on detainers. Because the evils which the agreement on detainers was attempting to avoid is not implicated. It's not simply a notice that a prosecutor filed with prison officials that sits in the prisoner's files for months and years without the possibility of trial, without the possibility of those charges being resolved. And that's what the agreement on detainers is designed to avoid. And when a writ of habeas corpus is issued by a court that's immediately executed and the prisoner is actually brought to trial and the matter is resolved, then the problems that the agreement on detainers was designed to address never become implicated. And I think it's clear in this case they were not. This case was expeditiously handled once the warden honored the writ issued by the Circuit Court for Ashland County.
Let's just double back again, make sure. With the writ of habeas corpus, there's a petition to the court by the district attorney.
That would be the normal
the
procedure.
Mm-hmm. And then the second page is a writ issued by the judge saying that you're commanded to deliver the body.
That is correct.
And in the first time it appears in the record, there's a criminal complaint and warrant. That's at page 59. The second time we have this writ, the complaint is not attached. Would this petition and writ be valid, in your opinion, if the complaint was not attached?
My answer is no. I don't think
it would not be valid.
It would not be relevant to the validity of the writ.
It is valid, even if it doesn't have the
consent. That is correct.
Okay.
That is simply, I think, for the court's convenience. Because obviously the complaint had been filed and an arrest warrant issued.
Shows that that it's substantial and that it's not just off the wall in effect.
I would agree, because those documents would be part of the court record prior to the petition.
All right. Now, tell me what a detainer would look like. If I understood it from the conversation, it would be a notice to the federal prison that this defendant has charges filed against him. And that would be it. And it may have the complaint, it may not have the complaint, but that would, is that right?
There is no formal definition within the agreement on detainers itself as to what a detainer is. It could possibly simply be a letter from the prosecutor or from the sheriff's office, although I think most prison officials would want some type of documentation, a complaint or a warrant to accompany it.
And if the other state or the federal government gets it, what's the effect? Now the prisoner is being released because they served time. Is there a notice to the state?
Yes. Basically what the prosecutor or law enforcement agency is asking of the warden is, there are untried charges in our jurisdiction. Don't release the prisoner without notifying us. Now, that also might have adverse consequences to the prisoner if that sat there for many months or years in terms of the programs you could participate in and so forth. And that is part of the concern which led to the enactment of the agreement on detainers and the procedures set out there.
What is it you want this court to hold?
I guess the bottom line would be simply to affirm the judgment in this case, because the use of the writ of habeas corpus issued by the state judge was not a detainer, applying United States versus Morrow to the facts of this case, and also to affirm the judgment because there is no prejudice whatsoever at any level to the defendant in this particular case. So I think both on terms of applying controlling federal law and just simply the equity of this case, the state would be asking the court to affirm the judgment of conviction entered in this case.
Do you think there are two ways of proceeding and either one is...
No, I would not put them on parallel grounds.
Okay.
Obviously, it's the position of the state that the rationale and the distinctions drawn by the United States Supreme Court and United States versus Morrow should be applied by this court to the facts of this case, and that should be the legal basis for the court's decision.
So is there any language in the Court of Appeals decision that you disagree with? I'm looking at, go ahead, anything that you disagree with?
I have nothing specific that I disagree with in terms of the language used or the obviously the final decision reached by the Court of Appeals.
Well, if we determine that a writ is not a detainer, and a detainer is not a writ, and a complaint does not change the nature of the writ, we can put a period on the opinion, can we not?
I would agree.
You don't have
I would
to
just add a citation to United States versus Morrow to support those specific sentences.
And the unpublished decision of the Court of Appeals. But you said, and then, because when the Chief asked you what we should write, you added the second part of the opinion, addressing the equities. Why do we need to address that?
There is no compelling reason to do so. I felt that I should point out to the Court that I do not perceive that there is any prejudice to the defendant in this case.
Is that relevant? Whether or not he was prejudiced? If there was a violation, is prejudice another prong of the analysis under the IAD?
That is a very good question. And I guess my response to you is, it is not.
So you probably said a little bit more than
I said more than I needed to and more than I should. We sometimes do that. If there are no further questions from the court, the state would rest on its argument presented this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Corbin.
Thank you, Justice. I would like to answer a question that was previously posed. There was a great deal of discussion during the course of the questioning about how this is a two-way street, how there was no prejudice, all of the dangers because of the procedure and because the writ here was immediately executed, all of the dangers do not occur because the prisoner was transferred at the same time, et cetera, et cetera. And I would pose a hypothetical to this court. That presumption is an unconstitutional one because it runs afoul of the Supremacy Clause. There is no guarantee with a state writ of habeas corpus.
But, counsel, would you agree that the Morrow Court is absolutely clear that a writ is not a detainer and a detainer is not a writ?
I would respectfully disagree.
But how else can you interpret the language of Morrow?
Well,
it says here, because writs of habeas corpus issued by a federal court are immediately executed, enactment of the agreement was not necessary to achieve their expeditious disposition. And then at the bottom it says, we therefore conclude that a writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum is not a detainer for purposes of this agreement. How could they be clearer?
Citing precisely from the portion that you've just provided, I would point to two provisions in that quote.
The first one is federal court, and the second one is immediately executed. The federal court can provide the guarantees that are necessary because of the supremacy clause. They can make a guarantee that their writ will be immediately executed. The state court can do no such thing. They have to rely on principles of comity. There is no guarantee that the state writ could have reached the prison warden, and the prison warden could have said, I'm ignoring this and throwing it in the garbage because the supremacy clause
says that. But then at that point, the state, if it wants the prisoner, issues a detainer consistent with the interstate agreement. And now they've got to act.
But a detainer, Justice, respectfully submitted, if anything, anything, however informal, that notifies the holding jurisdiction that a prisoner is wanted in another jurisdiction.
Yeah, but once that, as I understand the interstate agreement, once that detainer is received by the holding authority, they have to act if they are signatories to the interstate agreement. Am I wrong?
No, I understand your question. I'm not sure of the applicability or how to respond.
I thought, and maybe I misunderstood, but I thought that you were saying that, gee, if you go with a writ of habeas corpus, the holding authority can just discard it and not pay any attention because it's a state court and not a federal court. But
right.
What I'm saying to you is that there is a ready remedy for the state that wants that prisoner, and that is say, okay, if you throw our writ into the wastebasket, we're going to issue a detainer. And now you got to respond.
And respectfully submitted, the IAD is set up, one must remember the two purposes for the IAD. One is uniformity and the other is for the protection of prisoners. I'm not looking at this from the standpoint as an advocate for Mr. Easley of what the state might be able to do to clean up their mess. I'm looking at it from the standpoint of the IAD being enacted by the Congress, and this Congress of the state of Wisconsin is a constitutional guarantee, containing in it constitutional guarantees that are going to protect the prisoner. Because
am I wrong, though, counsel, in saying that the answer to the problem that you posed is for the state that wants the prisoner to issue a detainer?
Sure, they could try and employ that, but they would have already run afoul, in my humble opinion, of the interstate agreement on detainers. But in closing, I would just point out two things. The purpose for the IAD. First, I just want to ask the court one question that I would humbly request that you contemplate in your deliberations, and that is, what does the IAD mean? If the IAD, isn't the whole IAD, and especially Article 4, simply surplusage? It's not worth the paper it's written on. If we're going to allow prosecutors at will to simply just issue writs, why have an IAD procedure?
But a prosecutor can't issue a writ, counsel.
Well, then if the state court can, and as I've indicated, it would be my opinion that runs afoul of certain constitutional protections, but even with a state, even if it's a state judge that's issuing that writ with no guarantee that it will be enforced, why would a prosecutor ever seek anything other than that?
Thank you, counsel.
Good luck traveling back.
Yeah. take a 5-minute recess so that the students, if they wish, and others can leave and prepare for the next day. I think I'll just stop.